Good afternoon. The Southern panel starts a series of oral arguments this afternoon and continuing on to tomorrow. And our first today is Yvonne Cabrera versus the state. Are you ready to go, Ms. Erickson?
Yes. All right. Good afternoon, Justices Thiegert, Hardesty, and Silver. I represent Yvonne Cabrera, and I represented her at trial.
Ms. Erickson, I want to apologize for interrupting you. I think all of the counsel in the next case are here. I wanted to alert you to the fact that I intended to set your oral argument for 45 minutes rather than for 30 minutes. So you'll have additional time if you want to be thinking of all of the various things you'd like to tell us about.
I'm sorry, Justice, is that...
It's for the next case because they may want to rethink or add to some of the things they were otherwise going to say. But, Ms. Erickson, if you run over, there are some very interesting issues in your case and Mr. Giacomo's case as well. So we have some time this afternoon. We won't be too liberal with our time, but we'll do our best.
At this point, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for my rebuttal. In a criminal case, the state has broad, very broad discretion in determining what crimes to charge. In this case, the state decided to charge Ms. Cabrera with conspiracy to commit murder, 2 counts of attempt murder with use of a deadly weapon, 2 counts of first-degree murder, either through being an aider and abettor, a conspirator, or a participant in the felony for felony murder. A state also has a broad discretion in deciding whether to make a case capital or not. And in this case, the state also chose to use its discretion and decided to ask the court to give the jury 3 aggravators that I am challenging in this brief. There were 2 others, but they're not pertinent to the appeal today. One was before the penalty hearing, a person had been convicted of a felony involving the use or threat of violence to another. In this case, Ms. Cabrera had been convicted of 2 counts of attempted murder with use of a deadly weapon. The second was that the aggravator of committing by a person who knowingly created a great risk of death to more than one person by use of a weapon, course of action, or device. Again, that applied twice to Ms. Cabrera because there were 2 people that were murdered. And third, they decided to request the jury to apply the death penalty based on felony murder. And in this case, they put it on the burglary charge. And obviously, the exercise of this discretion is extremely broad. It's basically unchallengeable. But is it constitutional when that broad discretion also ends up allowing the state to preclude a defense in a capital murder trial? Because that's what happened here. They decided to make a capital, and Ms. Cabrera was precluded from having a defense, a duress defense. I also ask if it's...
As to murder.
Excuse me?
As to murder.
Yes. Well, no. As to all charges, actually. We move from the murder charge to all other crimes. The district court, the state argued, and the district court accepted that the state was required to prove the intent to kill. Therefore, somehow, NRS 194010 precluded duress as to those crimes. There is nowhere in any statute that we have that says duress applies to any crime if there is the intent to kill. So I think that's the easiest one to answer. It should never, ever have been precluded as to conspiracy to commit murder, knowing that's an agreement to commit murder, burglary while in possession of a firearm, that's not a capital offense, and then also the attempt murder. None of those are capital offenses. The Florida State was completely precluded from that. There is no language in the duress statute that says duress is not allowed if there is an intent, if the state has to prove intent to kill. Not that. They want you to write that in for them, and that's their entire argument, you know, is that we really should be able to do that, but the language of the statute is very clear. Sorry. There's no language that allows that, and this court has consistently said that it will not allow the language, that you will not interpret a statute unless the language, if the language is perfectly clear and means what it says.
So you agree, ma'am, for the capital offense, by the plain language, you don't get the duress instruction. This is a preliminary matter. The other ones, they should have been given the duress instruction. But you're also asking us to consider whether when you're an aider and abettor is what puts you into that, in that crime in a capital category, that you should be entitled to duress. Why don't you tell me about that?
Well, first, I'm asserting that applying that statute to an aider and abettor is unconstitutional. That statute and all of the statutes that rely on that in the states are based on the common law policy choice of evils. The choice of evils is, I'm standing here with a gun, and I point the gun at Mr. DiGiacomo and tell him to kill Your Honor. And he doesn't. The common law says that, of course, he can't be precluded, he can't get duress, because the person that actually kills the person is not an innocent party anymore. That's the common law policy. It's not the policy when I have a gun and I'm Jose, and I pointed at Yvonne, and she doesn't kill anyone. That is not the choice of evils policy. So it's just a misrepresentation to allow that to occur.
Yeah, the jury believed that it, under an aider and abettor theory, then she's not an innocent actor.
Well, I think...
Right?
Well, it comes down to that aspect.
Didn't they... There were special interrogatories, though, in this verdict form. And the special interrogatories, I mean, didn't find her to be aider or abettor. It looked like that she premeditated the murder. They also came back on premeditation. It wasn't just felony murder.
No, it was all three of them.
I understand what they charged.
But no, even in
when I looked at the verdict forms, I thought the interrogatories were pretty clear that they thought, you know, she was in on this.
But that's after we're precluded from having a defense. I mean, how can you take, you know, a penalty phase determination?
But you were able to argue that she was forced to do it. You could at least...
No, we didn't. We couldn't. We
you never
precluded.
Said to the jury that at all?
No. Well, I mean, my co-counsel may have said it once out of an hour argument, may have slipped out of his mouth. But no, there was absolutely no closing argument at the guilt phase that Ms. Cabrera was forced to do this. The state tries to say that it's appropriate that she doesn't get to have that because she got to testify in her own defense. Well, I'm sorry.
But then she says she was afraid of him and at least set up what appeared to be...
Well, yeah, she could say all that, but we didn't have a jury instruction. I couldn't argue what her testimony even meant. That's the problem. You know, that she got to testify. She got cross-examined and impeached with a statement that she gave when she was arrested that included facts regarding the duress, which was then introduced by the state, not by the defense.
And the party opponent, so they're
right. And
it's, wait until she testifies.
Right, it's appropriate. It's not, you know, not uncalled
right.
for. But then to argue that she can't have duress because, you know, it was appropriate to preclude duress because she got to testify, just means nothing. We all know juries don't know what anything means. There was no argument about duress. The argument, the closing argument, was mere presence, and that was it.
But Mr. DiGiacomo, once the court, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong on the record here, that once the court said, we're not going to give you a duress instruction as it relates to the capital offense, the defense then said, we don't want duress instruction given.
No.
Is that correct or no?
No. There was an initial challenge to the court allowing duress as to murder.
Okay.
Then, after that was decided, then they filed another motion to preclude duress as a defense to every other charge. The conspiracy murder, burglary, and attempt murder. We were not allowed to argue that. There was a jury instruction given, but that was because the state wanted it, and the state stood up and argued it. I didn't argue it. I asked it to be withdrawn.
So that's what I'm saying, is once you didn't get duress for the capital murder, the defense asked that a duress instruction not be given at all. Is that not correct?
No. The state at the very beginning of the trial changed the amended information to include the felony, the burglary, including not only the felony to commit murder, but also the statutory language of assault and battery. Duress applies, the state agreed. Duress applies to assault and battery. So before we did the closing arguments and while we were doing jury instructions, I asked for a duress instruction because it would address those, you know, two aspects. And then when I was doing my closing argument before we decided what the jury instruction would be, I realized it was stupid. There was an argument for duress as to battery and assault, nothing else. And Mr. Giacomo got up and said that to the jury. There's no duress as to offense. Duress is not a defense to conspiracy, burglary, attempt murder, and murder. He said that. We never. I asked for it to be withdrawn because the instructions in and of themselves as a aider and abettor required extensive thought to prove, you know, for the jury had to go through, did Ms. Cabrera intend for Jose to kill the person? Did she intend for the burglary to occur? And those, the instructions were just incredibly difficult given our Sharma and what the jury has to say. So before we did closing arguments and when I realized how difficult the jury instructions were going to be and the worthlessness of the instruction itself, I asked that it be withdrawn.
How is that an error, though, that then the state asked for it to be given? I'm going to liken it. I know you say that it's now used against your client as a sword, but how many times do we see, say, in other cases, where there's some evidence that somebody maybe has done meth before a killing, and the state asks for a voluntary intoxication instruction, but maybe the defense is self-defense?
Well, I think it's a little different because the person got, in that scenario, I could argue voluntary manslaughter then. Even if I didn't want it, I could. In this, the instruction given is, duress is not a defense to murder, attempt murder, conspiracy to commit murder, or burglary with the intent to commit murder. But duress may be a defense to burglary with the intent to commit assault and or battery. And it's error because the defendant must prove duress by a preponderance of the evidence. A preponderance means that it's not beyond reasonable doubt. The burden is less than beyond reasonable doubt. And the defendant acted in duress only if the acts were performed under threats or menaces sufficient to show. The instruction that was given and the preclusion of me from arguing duress as to any other crime was incredibly unfair.
Do you know, what is that instruction number offhand?
Number 41, it's at page 1996 of, I think that's number 10, 9 or 10, I'm sorry, I don't have the appendix with me. But I think that, you know, this whole thing, you know, is it constitutional to preclude a defendant from having a defense in a capital case when she is not the killer and the choice of evils does not apply to her? The common law is based on the choice of evils. And it clearly intends for a person who actually kills someone, not who doesn't do that. I only have 2 minutes and 45 seconds. I'd like to reserve it.
Okay, Ms. Harrison.
May it please the court, my name is Mark Giacomo. I represent the respondent in this action. I realize that the duress is the intellectual argument here, but I would like to just briefly address one other issue that jumped out at me in the briefs, which is the speedy trial argument that is made only because, it's an ongoing issue in the 8th JD, one. Two, reading this record, you can clearly see why we started the homicide program. But three, the brief doesn't fully sort of analyze the situation as it really was. And I'm just going to do it by way of the record. Our brief suggests that there was a 349-day delay in a case where a defendant hadn't waived her 60-day right. The case was originally indicted in September of 2012, and then we filed a notice of intent to seek the death penalty, and that's when Ms. Erickson gets appointed. Now, I wasn't the lawyer back then. I don't become the lawyer in this case until November of 2015. when Ms. Erickson comes in on the 17th of October, she says to the court, look, it's a capital case. I can be ready in May. And the objection that really occurs there is that the court sets it in October. So while there is a delay that's associated there, the defense says to the court, hey, I can be ready in this capital case by May. Then August 19th of 2013 comes along, which is, and the defendant filed, the co-defendant filed the motion to continue. And Ms. Erickson joins in that motion to continue, and on August 21st, 2013, the defendant waives. Now, all of that is what are the 349 versus what really is maybe 150 days, if you take what Ms. Erickson's suggesting. But what is more disturbing about that is that they're actually arguing that the invocation occurred until September of 2015. But when you continue going through the record, you move to 421 of 2014 when Ms. Erickson comes in and says that she is agreeing to a short continuance. And then on 421, 2014, she starts arguing vehemently to the court, my client's invoked. She's always wanted her right to a trial. We are ready for trial. In May of 2014, it gets continued to May of 2015. And here's where it gets disturbing to me. In March of 2015, Ms. Erickson makes a record that Mr. Whipple had fired the defense investigator. And then on March 16th of 2015, and this is at 360 in the appellant's appendix through about 370, she makes a record about how her own client doesn't have to take the stand to put on her duress defense, and that there are witnesses who will see her client being coerced by Smokey, and thus we can prove it that way. And then she says, but I don't know who those witnesses are. Our investigator was fired, and I found out recently that no guilt phase investigation had been done whatsoever. And this is now March of 2015, when the defense has been saying for that first year that they're claiming that they're having a violation of their speedy trial rights, that they're fully ready and we're ready to go the entire time. And then it is then on April of 2015 that Ms. Erickson asked for September of 2015, and they even concede as of September 2015, every continuance was theirs. So suggest that something the state did, or even the judge did here, that precluded the defendant from going to trial before she did, is just not very accurate. I will agree with you that there was not a very good canvas of the defendant when Ms. Erickson asked for, there's no canvas of the defendant when Ms. Erickson asked for that May 2013 date. And certainly until August of 2013, the defendant herself doesn't specifically say it. But obviously there is good cause in a capital case to continue it so your lawyer can investigate. And as of March of 2015, the lawyer still hadn't investigated whatsoever this case. So I don't really think that there's a speedy trial issue associated with the case.
Mr. DeJacquemont, I'd like to turn to the instructions, if I may. With respect to the plain language of 194.010 subsection 8, why wasn't the defendant entitled to a duress instruction, before we even get to the aider and abettor piece, on every other count except for the capital count?
Well, you have to ask yourself, what does 194.010 mean? And I will tell the court, and I did this with wide open eyes when I filed that motion, that there is not a lot of great law on this, and it's literally a policy consideration. But if you think about this, and it's easiest to think about it with the attempt murder versus the murder charges. So NRS 194 uses that archaic term from 1911 that says where it's a capital offense, which back in 1911, all murder cases were capital offenses. And then if you say to yourself, but it does, you can have a duress defense to an attempt murder charge. What does that mean? So that means this in real world time. I pick up a gun, I shoot somebody.
Right.
The moment I pull that trigger, if I'm under duress, I didn't commit a crime. 3 days later when they die in the hospital, now I'm guilty of the crime even though the acts I committed were 3 days before. To me, that's not what that statute says. It says, except for a capital case, and if you interpret, as every court that has looked at this has said, that's murder. Murder in the state of Nevada is 200.010.
It says crimes punishable with death. And the only crime punishable with death is the one count. So why don't the other, if I'm looking at the plain language of the statute, I don't have to dive into these other pools and swim. I can just say, hey, why don't you get it on these other?
That's true. And I would urge the court to look at the cases mm-hmm. like Vieira and Manning, who have interpreted that archaic language to mean that involved murder, right? And then Manning goes farther and does sort of this analysis that attempt murder, for example, charges two statutes. It charges the murder statute, which is 200.010, and 193.330. It's just a combination of two statutes. So while you may be able to use duress to an attempt, you cannot use it to the second half of the element, which is the murder. In each and every one of these statutes, 200.010 is charged.
Yeah, but it doesn't say elements punishable that collaboratively come to death. It says crimes punishable by death, and there's only one crime on that information punishable by death.
I completely agree that there is a reasonable interpretation you can make of that statute that says she's only entitled to duress in this particular case. Now, I would suggest to you that on the facts of this case, any error here is harmless, and I will confess to you the reason we've done this is because we have had a long-standing discussion on my unit, which is, can you have a duress defense to a felony murder situation where you have a duress, let's say, for the robbery, and you're not guilty of the robbery, but under the plain language of 194.010, you're still guilty of the felony murder rule. And a lot of courts have gone separate ways on whether or not the duress defense can or cannot apply to a felony murder rule. So the position I take and my office takes is, you can have a duress defense to any felony murder that does not involve the intent to kill. That once the intent to kill, which is what we believe that statute says, is you don't get to commit acts with the intention to kill somebody that you can excuse by saying, but I was scared of being killed. That's what we take 194.010 to mean.
What about the fact it's been amended several times since 1911, and certainly if the legislature wanted to change it, they certainly could have over all the times it's been amended.
Other subsections related to other affirmative defenses have been changed over the years, the major change being when this court found that that insanity was a constitutional right. But that section that deals with duress, and there's almost no law in the state of Nevada, either published or unpublished, even the published and unpublished orders that we have really don't discuss sort of the meaning of the phrase for duress. But I will say that in other subsections, this court has done, like in Love Camp in the necessity type defense, you've gone to a common law analysis and a policy consideration as to what policy did the legislature intend to enact at the time this statute was passed. And it is the position of the state that the court has to set the policy. Because if you do read the plain language of that statute, that a felony murder situation you would not get duress to. Because you might not be guilty of the robbery, but if the killing occurred during the course of that robbery, you'd still be guilty of the felony murder underlying the case. And so I actually think that's an unfair reading too. I would say that where 200.010 is charged, you do not have a duress defense. Now, the court could reject that, and let me just back up because I think Justice Silver brought this up, and it's at 2008 within the appendix, which is the verdict form. In the verdict form, this jury found that Ms. Cabrera willfully, with premeditation and deliberation, is guilty of murder. Did she pull the trigger? No, but that's irrelevant under Nevada law. An aider or abettor is a principal if they have the requisite intent. And why it is you make the argument that Chinola, which street term means boss, uses Smokey, whose street term is a shooter, who has the only motive here to kill these people, who is in the argument with these people, who Smokey doesn't know, she brings Smokey over, he's just the weapon. She could have held the gun, but no, she had Smokey go over and kill these people. Why would the law allow her to have a defense as an aider and abettor? What's the difference between her and Smokey when it comes to an analysis of a statute? There's none. Nevada law does not allow for it. And their entire brief in trying to preclude defense duress as a defense to murder, their argument is sort of an evidentiary argument that has no meaning. All of the cases they cite, the U.S. Supreme Court cases, are things like a state rule that precludes a defendant from presenting a third-party confession. It's an evidentiary rule. Or a state rule that precludes a co-defendant from calling another co-defendant even if there is no Fifth Amendment right. It's preventing evidence being presented in front of the jury. It is in no way substantive law. And there is no court on earth that's ever ruled that duress is unconstitutional. There's no legal support for it. I mean, as an old prosecutor once said, everybody's entitled to a defense, but not everybody has a defense. And the Nevada legislature has decided that if you're charged with murder, you don't get to say, well, I did it, but I was in fear for my life. I recognize that this court is going to have to, and I hope they give us some guidance on exactly what it is 194.010 says. It is my belief that if you intellectually look at this, if you read the Manning case, which is really the only case in the entire country, which is out of Washington, which we cite in our brief, which is the 448P3rd 367, they essentially do the analysis that I ultimately came to in this particular case, which is the difference between murder and attempt murder is a combination of two statutes, just like it is in the state of Nevada. And that when you combine a statute, conspiracy and murder, attempt murder and murder, burglary with the intent to commit murder, when you combine those statutes, what you're really saying and what that statute really means is if you have the intent to kill, you cannot argue that you are excused from that intent to kill merely because you have a fear for your life. Your obligation, as Justice Blackstone said so many years ago, is to resist and not to go and take an innocent life. So, and that was the duty that Ms. Cabrera had. And ultimately, no matter what it is you guys decide here, is one, I mean, the murder charges themselves, ultimately, you know, there's no legal basis to find that there was any errors as associated to those. But ask yourself legitimately if Yvonne Cabrera had a legitimate duress defense in this particular case, and the answer is, well, absolutely not. That's why, ultimately, whatever the decision of the court was, if there was error, if there was an error, but whatever it is was harmless. I mean, her first story was, I wasn't there until they tell her, hey, two of those girls that were shot center mass were there, saw you there. And then her story was, well, I only thought Smokey was going to scare them. I didn't know that. Well, in order to get the duress defense on, it would have to be, I was afraid he was going to kill me, but I only thought he was going to scare them. And ultimately, that wasn't an argument she was going to make very easily. So by the time of trial, she tries to claim, I thought he was going to kill me, so I took him over to a house that he didn't know where it was at, he didn't know these people, or nothing about them, and he killed them, and I have absolutely no reason why. Which ignores the evidence, which is Yvonne Cabrera had a beef with both male victims in this case. She had threatened one of those male victims earlier in the day, and even earlier that night had sent a text message to the other male victim saying, this is Smokey. She even admits to it, that she used Smokey's name as a threat. You know, she's not bringing the car back. She's sleeping. Knock it off. And she acknowledges that that was a threat she sent to these victims that night.
Mr. DeJacques, can I get your opinion on something here? On the,
sure.
On the 010 subsection 8, the one amendment was to change it from the crime be punishable by death to is punishable by death. What do you think the gravamen of that is? Do you think be punishable means it could be punishable by death, but they didn't charge it, and is means it is a capital case? To distinguish from a murder that you don't do capital, like what's the distinction there where the legislature did say be punishable by death versus is punishable by death?
You know, ultimately, I don't know the answer to what that distinction is. Mm-hmm. It would be, in some of these cases that actually talk about this, whether it's capital or if it's all murder, say that's a very dangerous interpretation for any court to give because it incentivizes prosecutors to file death notices. I never took the position, and I still don't take the position, that in order to preclude a defendant's defense, that there would be any logical reason to allow the prosecutor to make that decision by filing a notice of intent. So I think it's a very dangerous interpretation to take to say, in a case that is capital, the prosecutor can prevent the defense. Because I know what the facts are long before the defense attorneys do, and I'm the person that's charging that particular case. So you'd be incentivizing prosecutors to file death notices if we think there's a possibility there was a duress defense out there. And that would be, I mean, I'm not saying that that's ethical. I don't think it's appropriate. But in an illegal analysis as a court, I can't imagine a court making that interpretation because it would incentivize prosecutors that don't have much in the way of an ethical compass to potentially file a death notice merely because they believe the defense might be duress.
So you'd ask her an interpretation that says, if it is, I appreciate the other arguments, but is punishable means capable of being punishable by death.
Correct.
That's your position.
That would be my position. My position is that phrase means murder. And if that phrase is murder, then I believe that any time that 200-010 is part of a charge, essentially means that the defendant has to be proven to have an intent to kill. And where they have an intent to kill, there is no logical reason for you to apply duress in a situation where the results of the crime matter. And in the easiest interpretation, there is the attempt murder. That the difference between my acts being legal at one moment and then later through no fault of my own or through fortuitous, the guy dies, and now ultimately, now I've committed a crime, but 3 days ago I didn't commit a crime. And that seems like a really illogical interpretation to have of a statute that provides affirmative defenses. The idea here is public policy, and everyone says that that's what this is. This is a public policy consideration of the courts. And that public policy has to be that where you commit an act with the intent to kill, you don't get to say, but I was afraid of being killed myself. And if that's true, then she didn't deserve the defense to any of these particular charges. If there are no other questions, I would submit it to the court.
Any other questions?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll add 2 minutes to your rebuttal time, Ms. Erickson.
First, in response to Mr. DiGiacomo about the language and, you know, you're supposed to be interpreting it to have different impacts because a murder charge is capital. The language is capital. The law was enacted in 1912. The law was differed, but not as to the duress for capital murder in 1979. There was no change in 1981. There was no change in 2001. There was no change in 2003. There was no change in 2015. And it remains the same today. So if the intent of the statute is to preclude people, the state, preclude a defense based upon the intent to kill, they had all this time to bring it up. You know, it's a real concern for them, but they don't go to the legislature and they don't ask the legislature to change it. They're asking you to interpret a statute whose language is very clear. Only first-degree murder is a capital offense. Secondly, Mr. DiGiacomo asserts that all other cases have said that felony murder doesn't get a duress defense. In page 37 of the opening brief, I cited to you Arkansas, California, Colorado, Florida, Illinois, Kansas, Maryland, Mississippi, Ohio, Oklahoma, and Virginia all recognized duress as a defense to felony murder. So they gave you no names of cases. I gave you 12 or 13, 11, I don't know.
But still, when you say the felony murder, I did go back, I did look at the verdict once again, and it does say, that special interrogatory is that the murder was premeditated, deliberate, and willful.
But Judge, we were precluded from arguing that it wasn't. We argued mere presence. That doesn't even, you know, that doesn't really cover the willfulness in any way. You know, if I would have been able to argue duress, then yes, I would agree that that finding makes it different.
I'm talking about with the felony murder.
Well, they also found felony murder.
They were still unanimous on the premeditation part, too.
And they weren't instructed on duress. So, yes, they were premeditated because, of course, we had no duress, as Mr. DiGiacomo told you. And then, you know, and then we have all of these states that say felony murder is covered by duress. And finally, Mr. DiGiacomo asks you to go to Manerly as the case that, you know, discusses how the two statutes work together. Unfortunately, the Washington statute specifies that duress is not available for the crime of murder. Not capital punishment, murder. Of course, it's very understandable that that would not allow a defense of duress to attempt murder. That is murder. Ours does not say that. And all of the facts that Mr. DiGiacomo told you about this case are all his interpretation. our interpretation would be different, but no one ever heard our interpretation because we weren't allowed to argue duress as a defense to any crime in the case. And I'm now over my minutes.
No, I've given you some additional time.
I did want to bring up one issue, because one of the important issues in this case that's, I think, a first impression, is that this court has never really said, what does duress do? There's two competing ideas about it. Duress negates the ability to form intent, and it's not a voluntary act. Now, that's the minority view. And the majority view is that, you know, the person had the criminal intent, the person engaged in a criminal act, and then duress excuses or justifies that. I think in this whole realm of this argument, it's very important for this court to decide, what does duress do? And because we have no instruction from the court, and so it's something that's being, you know, thrown around. And I think that making that decision by this court is appropriate, and then from there you go to the rest of the arguments about the statute and all those other things. But I really urge the court to decide, what does duress, if it's available on the facts of a case, how does that affect the jury and the state and the arguments? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Erickson. Mr. DeJock.